IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I'm your host, Rakshit Shetty, a research analyst at Takshashila Institution. And today, we are going to discuss about the recent report released by the Climate Policy Initiative on financing adaptation in India. To talk about this issue today, I have Malini Chakravarti and Anandita Sikka from Climate Policy Initiative. Malini Chakravarti is a research manager at CPI. She has more than 2 decades of work experience in research and teaching. She has worked in public finance, multilateral climate finance, social protection, and international trade. She works on just transition and green finance work streams with a focus on public finance. Whereas Anandita Sikka is an analyst at CPI's Delhi office. Her work focuses on development and green and sustainable finance. Her expertise lies in urban development, policy and regulation analysis, and building tools and frameworks for nudging climate action. Welcome to our podcast, Malini and Anandita. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Rakshit. We're very excited to have this conversation with you.
Thanks so much, Rakshit. This has been a labor of love for us, and we are really excited to share the insights of our report with you. Thank you.
So for our listeners, Climate Policy Initiative is an analysis and advisory organization with deep expertise in finance and policy. Its mission is to help governments, businesses, and financial institutions drive economic growth while addressing climate change. And its vision is to build a sustainable, resilient, and inclusive global economy. The recent report on financing adaptation in India examines India's approach to adaptation, related investment needs, and funding gaps, as well as avenues for bridging these gaps through public and private finance. The report also delves into the existing challenges in financing adaptation efforts in India at the subnational level, as well as the potential ways in which adaptation finance can be scaled. So, to get the basics right, what's the difference between climate mitigation and adaptation? And why is financing adaptation in India crucial?
Right. So the science on climate change is very clear, right? Because of increased greenhouse gas emissions due to human activities, the temperature is rising. So we have long-term change in the temperature and weather patterns. And what's that? And it's leading to, of course, like I said, increased temperature, but also melting of ice caps and glaciers, rise in sea levels, an increase in severity and frequencies of storms, cyclones, floods, etc. Right. So within this, climate action includes 2 broad themes. One is mitigation, which is reducing emissions. So, you know, treating the root cause in some ways. And the other is adaptation. And adaptation means basically making adjustments to our social, economic systems, in short, basically coping up with the impacts of climate change, right? Now, within this context, adaptation's gaining a lot of prominence, even in the climate circles now, because we've already reached 1.1 degree Celsius temperature increase. And the Paris Agreement says, well, to avoid the most severe impacts of climate change, we should ideally strive for 1.5 degree temperature to limit warming to 1.5 degree increase and or maximum by 2 degrees. And even with the NDC targets, we're most likely on path to for a 2.9 degree temperature rise. Right? So within this context, we've sort of missed the window for mitigation, and which is why adaptation becomes very, very important. Right. And to come to your question about why is it important for India? Well, India is a particularly vulnerable country. Reports say that we're the 7th most vulnerable country in the world. Our hazard exposure is very high because of our coastline and the geographic, like mountains and other geographical features. but also our vulnerabilities are very high, right? For example, we have significant percentage of population below poverty line. We have a lot of people who depend on sectors like agriculture and tourism, and these sectors are particularly susceptible to climate impacts, right? And so basically, this means that our climate risk is very high. And just to give you some stat on this, last year, CSE came out with a report and they said, well, 86% of the days in the first 9 months of 2023, we had a climate disaster in some part of the world, in some part of the country, right? So we're talking about really high climate risk. And this means that the impacts on our economy, livelihoods are also very high, right? Again, to just quote, give you some statistics here, a study sort of finds that, you know, because of climate impacts, the agriculture productivity can reduce and the prices of cereal would increase. And this could lead to, you know, 50 million people, additional people getting pushed under poverty in India compared to the zero warming scenario. So in short, because of the high climate risk and because of our development trajectory, it is very important for India to focus and invest in adaptation action.
You made a perfect case of why financing adaptation is in India is important. But what's India's approach to climate adaptation? Can you provide insights on the policy environment for adaptation in India?
Yeah, thanks, Rakshit. So before I come to this issue of how India approaches adaptation, let me just point out that all over the world, development and adaptation are seen as being closely interlinked. So what this means, and that's exactly the same thing that you see in India, specifically in terms of India, what it does is it views adaptation benefits as co-benefits of development interventions. So, rather than focusing on initiatives exclusively aimed at climate impact, in India, the focus is on prioritizing interventions that further the country's development goals while serving climate objectives simultaneously, right? So if you look at, let's say, INDC or NDC, India says that, okay, India intends to better adapt to climate change by enhancing, and I'm emphasizing this, enhancing investment in development programs in climate vulnerable sectors, such as agriculture, water resources, coastal regions, etc. Now, so in terms of the approach, it's perfectly fine. But, this approach has its own set of challenges. And I'll explain what I mean by that. And this particularly happens when we do not have a systematic methodology in place to be able to understand that, the extent to which these development programs address climate risk and vulnerability. In that case, what happens is, it's very difficult to make a distinction between development and adaptation. So for instance, if you're talking about irrigation, now anybody can say we have been doing irrigation for decades, right? So that is where the thing becomes that, how is an irrigation program, it's of course a development program, but what aspect of it is an adaptation? So that is the thing that becomes very difficult to distinguish. And as a result, what happens is good development often tends to be, equated with adaptation action, and as a result, diffusing the focus on adaptation. Would you like to come in, Nanandita, please?
Yeah, I was just thinking when we started working on this report and we started looking at programs and schemes, there were a lot of schemes like NAREGA, which were categorized as adaptation. And one of our a lot of our initial conversations were just about how do we separate this out? How do we include it? Do we not include it? And how should we sort of present this issue in the report? So that was an interesting conversation for us as well. So yeah, just elaborating, picking up from what Malini said, in last 15 years, what's been super welcoming is that the adaptation ecosystem as a whole has developed a lot, right? In the report, we talk about policies, plans, institutions, and schemes and programs. So we look at these three buckets. And we've seen that in the last 15 years, multiple policies and plans have been initiated by the government, including the NAPCC in 2008 and the state action plans in 2009. We've set up multiple institutions at both national and state levels to manage to manage and implement some of the adaptation action. And we've seen that the government has either mainstreamed climate action in the current sectoral schemes. So you would see, say, schemes like Smart City or Amrut, where elements of climate action have been added so that adaptation can be financed. Or we've seen separate schemes also being launched for adaptation action. So, for example, last year's budget, which is often sort of called the Green Budget, introduced these two schemes, Mishti and Amrit Darohar, for adaptation. So the momentum from the government has been really encouraging on adaptation in India.
I'm working on a paper called "What Was the Role of Provinces in China in Combating Climate Change?" So actually, I'm analyzing all the action plans releases by these provinces, right? And how they align with the central government's framework related to 1% policy framework related to climate change. So my question is, why are states in India an important part of this conversation on adaptation, and how are they contributing?
Right. So states in India actually account for 60% of the general government expenditure, right, against the global average of about 30%, right? So states spend more is one on developmental activity. That's one aspect of it. And the second is that a lot of sectors that are important for adaptation, such as agriculture, urban development, water, are all state subjects in India. So it's under the state jurisdiction, which is why states become a very important part of the narrative in India.
Yeah, and to add to what Anandita said, you know, climate vulnerabilities are local. And hence so are adaptation interventions. So, you know, when we are talking about why states are important, because these are have to be done at the state levels, region level, district level, and you can go down to the last mile. Also, this again becomes even more important because of the new guidelines that have been set for state action plan on climate change. Here, a very important aspect that was being mentioned is that, you know, whatever the states put up in their plans, as in SAPCCs, that has to be totally financed through state budgets. So that also makes it imperative. I mean, it puts almost the entire responsibility on states to design, to implement, and to fund adaptation-related action. So therefore, the state governments are actually at the forefront when it comes to adaptation action in India.
This is a layman guess, but I think the states which are really vulnerable to disasters like Odisha and other states would be really active in, you know, putting out plans on adaptation, right? Because I've seen this trend in the provinces in China. So just to take on this, like, what's the scene? Are all the states motivated on the same level, or is it only states which are really, really vulnerable to the climate change or disasters?
That's a very interesting question, because in report, I remember when we were drafting the chapter on policies, we had this sentence that said that states have moved with a varying pace and motivation, something like that, and which was to say that different states move differently. So you're right in terms, Odisha is an exceptional state, so they've had SAPCCs every 5 years. Tamil Nadu is one state that has done tremendously well on SAPCCs. But I'm not sure if we found any correlation on vulnerabilities and states putting out state action plans. I don't know if that kind of data exists in India.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But yeah, as Anandita said, that, you know, we have looked at in our report, for instance, all the updated SAPCCs that were available, publicly available, up to, let's say, September, October 2023. So we do see a mix of states. Yeah. So, you know, you have Odisha, which is supposed to be extremely climate vulnerable, but we also have Haryana,
yeah,
which has put out, then other end, we have Himachal Pradesh, which has done it. So it's not the new SAPCCs. I think there might be other factors at work rather than, so what, when we are saying, you know, the pace and this thing has moved at a different pace, we are actually talking about the first set of SAPCCs.
But you know what's also interesting about India is that the government of India took out a vulnerability assessment of states and districts in 2018. And if you look at the vulnerability assessment, there isn't a lot of difference in, say, like vulnerability of the most vulnerable and the least vulnerable. So that assessment tells us actually the vulnerabilities are different for each state, but most states in India are actually very, very vulnerable to climate action. So that is also one sort of point to consider here.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, but I would still take the point that, you know, even within that, yes, the range of vulnerability does not really, is not very high. But even within that, there are a couple of states which are more vulnerable. So that's exactly something we also take that into account when we say that what needs to be done.
Hmm. The report is based on the assessment of the State Action Plan for Climate Change, SAPCCs, right? Could you please bring up our listeners up to the speed on the conversation of SAPPs?
Sure, yeah. Just like we mentioned, there have been two rounds of SAPCC. So the government directed the states to draft state climate action plans in 2009. And the states were supposed to compile a climate profile, conduct vulnerability assessment, and propose a list of intended actions. Right. It's also important to note that states were also supposed to indicate incremental or additional costs for these activities. Well, the states, again, moved with varying sort of motivation on this. But overall, there has been a lot of, scholars have believed that, you know, these plans lacked technical skills. And I mean, this is the first time states are looking at issues like climate change, right? So, of course, the technical skills didn't exist at the state or local levels. And at that point, there was no vulnerability assessment framework given to states. So states have also used different methodologies to assess vulnerability. And the data was also sort of lacking. So what that means is that the first set of SAPCCs, at least, were largely good development plans. The science behind it wasn't very, at least the science behind the vulnerability assessments wasn't very strong. And there was also some ambiguity on who's financing these plans. So a lot of these issues sort of existed in the first set of SAPCCs. In 2018, due to developments in climate science and other methodologies, the government issued guidelines for states to update their SAPCCs and align it to the NDC period, align it to the current policies, national policies, and SDGs and other things. And which is where sort of our assessment comes. So like Malini mentioned, till September of 2023, 9 states had released their SAPCCs, which is what we're assessing in the report. And these are important because they give us a sense of what's going at the subnational level and give us numbers on what states need to finance and how much is the gap, etc.
And which are these 9 states?
Okay, so these are Orissa, Tamil Nadu, Kerala, Haryana, Himachal Pradesh, Goa. Then there are Rajasthan, Gujarat.
Madhya Pradesh.
Madhya Pradesh is not part of this. Rajasthan and Gujarat. Madhya Pradesh, yes, we did find, document online, but it has an embargo. So we decided not to use it.
Oh, yeah, right. Sorry.
So these are the states, right?
And what are the estimates for the adaptation investment needs at the national and state level?
Right. The national level, you know, what we realized that national level, let me just give you a quick this thing of, it's very difficult to assess adaptation investment needs. And this is so all over the world. Also, one reason, as I said, is because, you know, development and adaptation are closely intertwined, right? Second is when we're talking about future climate risks, that also because there is a lot of uncertainty regarding this. So therefore, you do not really find much literature on adaptation financing need. This is true across the world, and this is true even in case of India. But we do have 2 reports at least by now and some other, you know, more recent assessments. So for instance, INDC, which is not really an estimate, but it kind of puts out a number and says that India as a whole, for the period 2015 to 2030, requires about $206 billion. Another report which had come out in 2020, this is by Department of Economic Affairs, Ministry of Finance, that said that round about the same period, that is over the same period, India needs about 85.6 lakh trillion INR, which approximately comes to around 1 trillion USD for this entire period. So the investment needs, when we look at the national level, these are the numbers are out there in any case, these are large. What we did in our report is try and estimate what are the investment needs at the state level, and that too, as Anandita said, through the updated SMCCs. And what we find is that, before I tell you the numbers actually, I'd also like to point out that despite the directive that, you know, states need to provide their, what are the adaptation investment needs or the climate change investment needs in their SMCCs, some states do not provide any estimates. So Rajasthan and Gujarat do not. Gujarat does give it, but it's only for 2 years, not for the entire period. And this time, SAPCC, another unique feature has been that it is linked with the NDC period. So it's up from 2021 to 2030.
Yeah.
So now, these two don't. The others do. So Odisha... So all these states together, when we calculated, we realized that on an annual basis, just these six states need about 445 INR billion annually, which translates to around USD 5 billion, which is a huge number, right? Yeah. But here I also must point out that, you know, these numbers, when we look at the numbers, what we also notice that a lot of these states, SAPCCs point out that the investment needs that they mention in their SAPCCs are actually much likely to be much higher in reality.
Yeah.
Because they are not putting out all the numbers because they really don't know where the funding is going to come from.
And as a matter of fact, in a lot of SAPCCs, in their estimates, they've listed a lot of climate action activities and not assigned any budget to it. So again, that estimate then becomes muted in that form as well.
Yeah, exactly. So the main point is the numbers are huge,
yeah,
but in reality, the numbers are likely to be higher.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
Right. You mentioned, Malini, that the states are not putting out the numbers. What is the reason of this? I mean, what's the reason?
Well, as I said, it is most of the time, and that brings us to the question, to the next question, which is about, you know, okay, funding gap. This is basic crux of it. A lot of these states, for instance, Goa has several activities listed under the tourism sector, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But it clearly says, we don't know where the money would come from. These actions need to be taken, but we can't really give out a budget proposal or the budget estimate because we don't know where the money is going to come from.
Yeah.
But they're very clear that these need to be done. So yes, one reason definitely seems to be not enough funds, not enough resources.
And do they have the ability to meet their adaptation investment needs?
Yeah. I mean, kind of building on from what I just said, that, you know, that was our main question. Okay. SAPCC has put out these numbers of the investment needs. And as I said earlier, that directives are very clear. States need to finance them from their own budgets, right? Now, so we wanted to understand, okay, do states face any funding gap? As in, do they have the ability to meet the investment needs from their own budgets? This was a relatively more difficult task because what we realized is most states really do not put out the numbers. Two states do, which is Odisha and Tamil Nadu. So we dug into the SAPCCs, tried to understand which ones are adaptation. Say, for instance, in the case of Odisha, it was very well crafted, so it was easier. In the case of Tamil Nadu, we had to plod through a bit. But we realized the funny thing is, you know, all SAPCs, almost all of them, even when they don't give you a quantified funding gap or a number, concrete number on the gap, all of them almost universally allude to the fact that there is not enough finances. So Goa does it, Kerala does it, Karnataka does it. Tamil Nadu and Orissa, of course, say it out very clearly that this is not going to be enough. We need more resources to be able to meet our adaptation investment needs.
Yeah. Also, just to Goa, again, like Malini said, only Odisha and Tamil Nadu give the number. I mean, Himachal also sort of gives the number a little bit, but it's mentioned in one section. In other sections, it sort of says that they have enough funds. Same as with Goa. Goa says that we have enough funds to, you know, finance these activities out of our state budget. But then you come to the list of activities, there are a bunch of list of activities where they don't propose any budget at all. So the point of this is that SEPCCs themselves are very complicated documents to sort of maneuver in terms of getting a number, getting a number for need or the gap.
Yeah, very. And, you know, I mean, the whole thing is they also have a section on, okay, where else are you going to get the money? I mean, what are the sources of that you're looking for? So if you look at that particular financing of SEPCCs, you'll see it's all the usual sources, international fund from the central government, etc., etc.
And what are the key barriers hindering states from adequately financing adaptation measures?
Okay, so, you know, I'll spend a little time on this, because when we talk about key barriers, the first thing is to understand what are the sources of, where do states get their money from, right? Like Anandita said, that states in India spent more than 60% compared to the global average of 30%. On the flip side, because our fiscal federal structure is such that it's the center which, you know, accumulates most of the tax or mobilizes most of the tax money. So therefore, for states to be able to meet their expenditure needs, they depend on transfer from center to state. So that intergovernmental fiscal transfer is a very important element, which is for states to meet their expenditure and therefore to be able to meet their adaptation expenditure needs. Then, of course, there's usually, you know, we all know that their own revenues, which can be tax revenues, non-tax revenue. Another very important factor that becomes very important, as you know, that, you know, all states are allowed to borrow. So there is a borrowing also finances many of these adaptation investment needs. But in India, there is a borrowing limit for all states, which is generally 3% of GSDP, that is states' GDP, unless there are exceptional circumstances, say in the case of what happened in COVID. There's a fourth element, which is an extra budgetary borrowing, and this has been done specifically by a number of states. You don't get data so easily, but states do resort to that extra budgetary borrowing to be able to, for two things, to be able to meet their finance needs, but also not crossing over the fiscal deficit limits. Now, what has happened over the last few years, state finances have been strained for a number of reasons. I'm not going into the details, but in general, what has happened is they have been able to, on an average, keep within the limit. Now, today, the situation is slightly different. One reason for that is, of course, the COVID-19 impact that has had on fiscal position across the world, states across the world, as in governments across the world. And it has been so even in case of India. Now, during this period, because, you know, the lockdown, the complete cessation of economic activities during COVID meant that government doesn't earn much in terms of tax revenue, right? So therefore, what was done is the center allowed, or rather the finance commission, allowed states to be able to borrow more. But this was a short-term, expansion of borrowing limit. And there is also a guide path that the finance commission has put in for states to come back to the usual borrowing limit. Starting from the year 2023-24. So we analyzed what is the position of state borrowing, and we realized that most of the states actually are far above their borrowing limit as of 2022-23, which in effect means they have to sharply cut down their borrowing or curtail their expenditure. Another very important thing that has happened during this period, which is a good thing because it means more transparency, and that relates to the off-budget borrowing that states have been resorting to. Now, in 2022, March up to July, somewhere the central government said that, you know, whatever states do show as off-budget borrowing, now that will be taken as part of their borrowing and that will decide their borrowing limit, how much they can borrow going forward. Mm. This again puts, you know, a further restriction on how much states can borrow. And when I'm focusing on borrowing, the simple reason it, if you look at all the sources that I mentioned, intergovernmental fiscal transfers, of which finance commission transfer plays a very important role, right? Mm. Then you have centrally sponsored schemes, central sector schemes and all that. Then you have taxes. Now, when you look at intergovernmental fiscal transfers, whether it's finance commission or centrally sponsored schemes, these are not, I mean, states really cannot decide how much is going to happen, right? It's not under their control. Similarly, tax revenue, not really. Depends on a whole lot of things, including the state of the economy. So if states can, you know, have to meet the additional expenditure, then what is the option? Borrowing. But what we see, it's really not. That option is really not there. So this is the main constraint we realize that states would not be able to.
And what are the potential solutions that you suggest in your report?
So coming back to solutions and building on what Malini said about state of state finances, in the report, we focus on two broad buckets. We say, well, strengthen the state public system, increase the fiscal space for the states. And that would mean that include vulnerability for the formula and for 16 Finance Commission, look at the borrowing limits, look at climate budgeting, tracking, improving quality of data, etc. And then we say that improve while doing all of this by strengthening the state public finance system, with that attract larger amount of private participation and adaptation, which is difficult, we understand that. But we feel that some efforts on PPP models or putting out a project database, building a pipeline of adaptation projects, or assuring minimum investment returns, or actually looking at some innovative financial models might actually help the case a little bit.
And you talk about fiscal space. How do you envision the role of India's upcoming Finance Commission in integrating adaptation-related interventions into the criteria for fund allocation to state governments?
Yeah, right. Thanks, Rakshit, because this is one of our central recommendations. Because as I said that, you know, finance commission transfers play a crucial, use this crucial node in adaptation financing at the level of states. One reason is because these transfers, you know, also give the states the autonomy and the fiscal space to be able to design the state-specific adaptation investment schemes and programs. Now, what we are seeing, and this is we take it from what has been happening, let's say, over the last few finance commissions, started from 12, but 14th and 15 did it more concretely, which is they have brought in certain climate elements when transferring to states as one of the criteria, right? So forest cover has been a very important criteria that has been incorporated when deciding transfers to states. Similarly, they have also brought in increasing support for disaster preparedness. It is in this context that we say these are all fine. But, you know, what is important right now is to have climate vulnerability taken into account when, you know, transferring to states and how to be distributed between states, take into account the climate vulnerability and risk that each state faces. And that can be done because government has also, the Department of Science and Technology has also come out with a comprehensive common framework to be able to understand what is the climate risk and vulnerability of states, which helps you rank states in terms of vulnerability and climate risk. So that can definitely be used as one element to incorporate these aspects and build or rather transfer money to the more vulnerable states or decide on the transfer of how much goes to each states based on these.
Could you also please elaborate on the time-bound climate incentivized borrowings in the states that you recommend in the report?
Yeah, sure. This is also we thought this would be a very important thing because, as I said, if you remember, that, you know, in India, for instance, for all states, the amount they can borrow as percentage of their GSDP is generally fixed at 3%. But what we also realize that, you know, climate risk and vulnerability are not uniform across states, right? So it is in this context, we have said that, okay, why not have climate incentivized borrowing ceilings that account for state-specific climate risk and vulnerabilities? So what can do is that when you do that, so what it means is states which are more vulnerable can be giving a higher ceiling for a specific period of time. Now, this enhanced borrowing ceiling can be made conditional on states investing in adaptation-related interventions. What this does is, it reduces, if states do take these steps and have the money to be able to do so, it reduces the adverse effects of climate change on GSDP. And that by itself can increase their fiscal capacity in the future, or rather at least doesn't decrease their future fiscal capacity in the future. We also do put a clause, though, that, on average, the 3% limit should be there across all states so that, you know, only states with additional adaptation investment needs and capacity to implement get to borrow more. We also say that, you know, okay, to curb fiscal profligacy, which is a possibility, it is very important to have adequate safeguards in terms of tax collection, increase in tax collections and revenues from other sources. So this thing is very specific, that make it climate incentivized, that you invest in adaptation and also time bound. So it's not like endless.
And among one of the potential solutions that you guys have recommended in the report is to mobilize private finance to address gaps in adaptation funding, right? So in that context, what are the barriers in attracting private finance in adaptation? And what can be done to attract, you know, more private finance to adaptation?
Okay, so I'll just go over this quickly because we are also coming to the close of time. That, you know, there are a number of reasons why private finance is less than what it could be, or the potential is there, but it doesn't happen. And this is true across the world, you know. If you look at we do this landscape tracking, green finance tracking globally. So if you say what is being invested in adaptation by private finance is just barely about 2%. So this is true across the world. And there are a number of reasons. For instance, there are knowledge gaps in terms of, okay, what are the climate risks? We do not have that kind of data in place, right? Including exposure to climate change risk and vulnerability mapped to different locations. Then there is, of course, uncertain investment return. Because you see, these can also be long-term investment with long gestation lag, which does not bring a return immediately. So one doesn't know what is going to be the return, one. So there's an uncertainty of return and it can come God knows where. Then, so these are some of the, you know, there are a lot of that we discuss in our report. But just to say that, you know, the unfavorable risk return profile, lack of bankable projects, whole lot of things kind of does not create a atmosphere for private investment to come into adaptation. And in that context, we do provide some recommendations, which is that, okay, you know, in for a country like India, for instance, one would be a very important thing is, we see that, for instance, in infrastructure, public-private partnership is a model that has worked in India. So when we are talking about adaptation or resilient infrastructure, that is one model that needs to be brought in. And the kind of model that we are talking about is where the private sector takes on the risk of financing it. So it does not put the burden on the government exchequer immediately. But the government comes in because it kind of ensures a return or a stable return over a period of time. So one is that. Second is we are also talking about, you know, prepare a database. Have a database, connect with the private sector. give them a sense of, let's say, okay, what are the projects that can be done in a particular region or local, I mean, region or district? What are the, who are the credit, I mean, who are the people who can do this? What is the credit worthiness of that? All this information, put it out in the public. And then maybe the private sector can get attracted. We have a similar kind of thing in the global...
Yeah, we do it in CPI runs this thing called the Global Innovation Lab, where we look at a lot of innovative financing models for climate action and support them so that they become scalable. And some of our own proponents have worked on adaptation, and that's worked really well. But on this also, I think the Goa government also recently set up a blended financing facility where they're sort of focusing on climate action and saying that the government is ready to support or take a higher risk, well, when it comes to climate action projects. So I think there is a lot of momentum to at least incentivize private sector to come into adaptation action.
Yeah, I mean, a lot is happening, and I'm sure going forward, we will be seeing much more in this and much more conversation around this.
Yeah.
That's a really great set of recommendations. So coming to the final part of our podcast, do you guys have any last comments, insights, or recommendations for our listeners about this topic?
In terms of last comments, I think just sort of summarizing, I mean, it's been a great learning journey for us. And it's also very encouraging that the conversations on some of these things are picking up, that the states are sort of looking at some of these climate action and specifically adaptation more seriously, that there's a lot of mainstreaming in sectoral policies. And I think going forward, with more and more SIPCCs coming, I think the adaptation action in India should really pick up. And that's very interesting and encouraging to see, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, to add on to this, in terms of private financing, what we also feel is that, it is time that we understand that the focus should be on minimizing or managing risk rather just looking at returns.
Yeah.
And we do feel that that is also going to come very soon.
Yeah.
I think these are very encouraging, and we would of course, we're looking at this even more closely going forward.
And I think one really, really important takeaway from our conversation that I can share with my that I want to share with my listeners is the importance of increasing state fiscal space and mobilizing private finance to address gaps in adaptation funding. That's which are the solutions from your report. And
yes,
thank you so much, Malini and Anandita, for sharing your insights and taking the time to be here with us. And to all our listeners, if you want to read more about this report, we'll have the link attached to our podcast in the below description. You can check it out there. Thank you for tuning in, and see you all in the next episode of All Things Policy.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.